Hi, I'm Lane Hartzell, and I'm here with David Rovix in Portland, Oregon, who is a musician and songwriter, and also has written some recent articles in Counterpunch that we're going to talk about today. Hi, David.
Hey, Lane.
I wanted to look at some of the writings that you've done related particularly to the current conflicts in the U.S., conflicts that they seem to be, well, they're talked about as being race, or the left and the right, feminism, social justice, and there's a lot of different terms that are thrown out there. So I want to talk about that with you, and then also about the democratic movements that we've seen throughout U.S. history that are, interestingly enough, not very much talked about, and massive ones like Blair Mountain that we'll talk about. There's extreme sides, obviously, and it looks like to me that it's, and to many, that it's gotten to be so extreme that it's the society is virtually breaking down, including, you know, on January 6th was an uprising violently to interrupt the legal process of the society, which is, to elect the president, which is very scary and illegal. So I want to go into this with you. And get your views on this, and also what you're thinking about for a better society and some of the current projects you're working on. So let's start off with the terms. How do you see the right and the left and so forth?
Yeah, the whole right-left thing is, it's gone through a lot of evolution over the centuries and decades, I guess. But traditionally, I guess it was always like the left was understood by many, including probably, I'd say, the overwhelming majority of the supporters of the left, or people consider themselves on the left, they would think of themselves as being representing the interests of the working class. And the right, certainly from the perspective of the left, would be generally seen as representing the interests of the ruling class. And of course, that's not how the grassroots supporters of the right would have seen things necessarily, and that's not how a lot of other folks would see things. But of course, this has all changed in the past few decades, and this is, you can hear it on the mainstream media talked about regularly, about how the Republicans are trying to position themselves as a party of the working class, which would have sounded like a ridiculous notion a few decades ago. But now it seems less ridiculous, and the only reason it seems less ridiculous, or the main reason, is because the Democrats basically abandoned the interests of the working class a long time ago when they embraced basically big business and empire and these free trade deals and all sorts of other stuff, and this process that you could track down to at different points in history, but certainly many people would say the social contract that existed between capital and labor that was broken by the 1970s, or certainly by the 80s. And a trajectory very familiar to a lot of people in Europe, where the timeline, at least especially in England, was kind of similar with the attack on labor and the sort of collapse of the labor movement to a large extent.
In the U.S. today, you hear talk of even democratic socialism. So there's the Trump kind of right that says the elites are oppressing us, and on the other side there are other sides. There's the fact that the elites are oppressing us. We need democratic socialism. There is actually a similar, you write in your article, there's a similar view, right? Both sides, or all sides, are saying we're being oppressed by the elites. But then you also, and of course, most people know about Trump and so forth. What is this democratic socialism that's coming about? And, principally with, say, Sanders, the Squad, and so forth.
Well, I mean, the democratic socialist phenomenon in the U.S. has been one of the main hopeful developments in recent years. The growth of the Democratic Socialist Party, but also of just the tendency within the Democratic Party, which of course is becoming stronger, I guess you could say, and especially during the pandemic, although that's very arguable whether that's really true or not, because I think we can see imperial policies of the empire, you know, continuing under Biden, as any critic of Biden would have expected them to. But in terms of some of the domestic policies that are being enacted, you know, in terms of like child credit for kids and health care policies and things related to housing, all the very temporary kind of like eviction moratoriums and stuff. I mean, these are all sort of the kinds of policies that folks like Sanders and AOC have been advocating for a long time. So, but I mean, and their voices are being loud and clear in many ways. And of course, when Sanders was running in 2016, the polls indicated that if the race came to him and Trump, that he would have won. And a lot of people are confused about that. And if people are confused about that, it's probably because they are paying too much attention to one end of the media spectrum and not the other, or they don't understand that people are joining the right wing groups and the Republicans and become Trump followers or Proud Boys or any number of other kinds of things. They join these groups because of in many cases the same kinds of motivations that makes people become campaigners for the Sanders campaign or something like that. I mean, they are looking for change, and they're hearing candidates like Trump or Sanders or others talking about the working class, which is not normally something the Republicans are known for doing, but Trump did it every day when he was running for office, you know, which is why he, which was one of the reasons why he gained a significant working class following, you know, because he was actually talking about changing the trajectory in terms of like deindustrialization and stuff like that, you know, good jobs. Now, he didn't talk much about unions, but he talked about, you know, the jobs coming back and that sort of thing. Biden talks about unions, but doesn't make it very clear like what his program is for how, I mean, other than the Green New Deal, which is a, if and what, not that he's calling it that, that's, you know, but that's the sort of thing they're trying to now, I mean, that's the sort of policies I guess they're trying to implement now if this $3.5 trillion thing actually gets passed.
Yeah, that's coming up. And I want to talk to you about the evictions at the end as we look at more of your practical work, because that's a very serious matter. And I think it's just coming up in Congress that they've relaxed that or something, right? Or they allow for people to be thrown out.
Well, the CDC had an eviction moratorium that the Supreme Court ultimately annulled, and Congress has failed to pass any new real legislation that would do anything about the situation, aside from rental assistance, which is failing to get to the renters or to the landlords. In half the cases, they don't even know it exists, and you know, in the other half of the cases, it's just not getting where it needs to go. It's like 10% of it or something has actually gotten it to where it's supposed to go. So, you know, and it wasn't enough to begin with, but, you know, considering the costs of housing and the crisis that already existed and predated the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is a really massive wave of evictions coming up. Action is not taken by the Congress or by, you know, I mean, of course it depends on the state, because in some states the eviction moratorium is a local thing, and it extends to the end of the year, places like New York and Oregon.
Right, and it's getting cold there. It's starting to get, you know, well, it's autumn now, it'll be chilly, you know, in say Virginia and across on up, and then within say 2 months it could be some snow. Even down to that, to say Virginia and so forth. So from there on up, it's probably going to be really rough. And this is something that's certainly worth people looking into, and we'll get to it. Going back to defining the terms, the way that socialist is used in the United States is really interesting, because the classical use of socialism is that workers own their work, or the core, that's the core of socialism. Could you just talk a little bit about that before we move into, you know, the history that you've been writing about?
The way that people use the term socialism in the United States, particularly in not just among democratic socialist circles, but also among other circles, especially to the right of the democratic socialists, when they are characterizing the democratic socialists, you know, they talk about socialism in Europe, and, you know, much of the rest of the world. It's not socialism to just have basic government policies involving the functioning of society. You know, it's just social. It's just basic social policy. It's what government does, like a public health sector. If it exists, if you have a public health sector, it's looking out for the health of the public. And, you know, like, that's what it does. Like, that's what a functional public health sector in a functional society does. And that's not in Europe, by European standards, that's just considered a functional government. That's not considered socialism. And socialism,
right?
I'm in Berlin. More impressive, you know.
Right, I'm in Berlin and in Northern Europe right now. And yeah, you know, if you go here on up around, there's the capitalism is quite vibrant, and yet there's this whole social policy project that you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think, doesn't Merkel call it the market? Does he call it market socialism or social capitalism? I don't know, but there's different terms, and how, I don't know how they're translated necessarily, but these are just normal terms and normal understandings, and not contradictory in any kind of fundamental way, the way that they would be thought of by much of American society. Like, oh, we can't have, you know, somehow if the government is involved, it was paving the roads, then, you know, that's going to lead to the gulags or something. I mean, it's just bizarre kind of thinking. It's hard to even kind of, you know, get your head around, because it all involves a century of anti-communist propaganda that never made a whole lot of sense in the first place, you know. But when you've been swallowing this stuff generation after generation, and it never made much sense in the first place, you know, now it's gotten to where, you know, these words are just, you know, they're just meaningless words that mean evil. You know, they don't mean anything right to people here in any kind of like way that they can explain, you know.
And so moving from this, which is really excellent understanding for the terms, into you took up the 100 years ago, there was an uprising. And in fact, there was a number of things going on at the time, from say 1917 on up to 1921 and so forth. I want to get into this because this aspect of history is really important, and yet it's not, we don't hear much about it. So you write that at Blair Mountain, there was an uprising. We had a 100th anniversary recently, and you say that, you know, American citizens should know with this history. Can you talk more about this?
It's a really long-standing problem that to take the example of our public television network here, PBS, and National Public Radio, it goes back to the founding of these networks, that they have been systematically, intentionally ignoring labor history. And it's not at all unique to those networks, but I have a lot of dirt on those networks in particular. But it's clearly also the case with CNN and all the other major networks. They just don't want to talk about labor history. They don't want to talk about class, and they don't want to talk about what the working class has in common, because these entities that run our media, as well as the ones that run our educational framework, and you know, they're not neutral, and they have a political agenda, and it is to serve the interests of the ruling class in this country, and they can't let the working class know that it exists. In order to effectively serve the ruling class, you can't let the people know that they are a people, and you have to keep them divided. And so So, and this is very, I'm simplifying things, and it's very complicated phenomena, but, you know, and we do have this massive, real ongoing history of white supremacy in this country, and racism, and other forms of discrimination, but particularly racism is fundamental to the economics and to the society, and has been for 500 years. And that cannot be really overstated, but while not without overstating the realities of white supremacy, if you at the same time as you're talking about the pogrom in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that they call the Tulsa race massacre, and these other things that have been largely written out of history but have been talked about a lot in the media over the past few months, if you're going to talk about things like the Tulsa race massacre and not talk about things like the Battle of Blair Mountain, which happened to have, it occurred only 3 months later during the same year, 100 years ago in 1921, in the same year after of the Tulsa race massacre, which in case people haven't heard of it, is when white mobs descended upon a black neighborhood in Tulsa and burned it to the ground, killed hundreds of people and created thousands of refugees. And that's just the beginning of the tragedy that took place there. But 3 months later in West Virginia, you had an uprising, which is being talked about a little bit in the media today because it's the centenary of it. But even when it's talked about in the media, the relevance of it in terms of race is not mentioned. And that's also tragic and bizarre. But the fact is that this uprising 100 years ago in West Virginia was the biggest armed uprising in the history of this country. And it was a multiracial uprising. There, of the 15,000 participants, 2,000 of them were black, and which is more or less about what the kind of proportions would have been in terms of the coal mines. And so it's not surprising that this was the case.
Let me interject that, interestingly enough, also Native American women, a large amount were involved in these actions too. We're talking about the whole society,
Oklahoma,
right?
In the Green Corn Uprising in Oklahoma. Certainly in 1917, there was a very significant, and of course, this is Oklahoma, which had and has a very significant Native population, of course, because historically so many tribes were forcibly moved to Oklahoma. But Oklahoma, the Green Corn Uprising was a cross intersectional, you know, uprising involving people of all backgrounds, race and gender, and including prominent Native American women leadership. Yeah.
So the both of these, large events in history, you know, of course, the race massacre in Tulsa, we know something about, because it has gotten some attention here in recent years. And there's the 1619 project and so forth, and when the boat showed up in Yorktown, which started off the slavery and so forth. I think it was about 20 slaves on that ship. Now, if the conditions, say, for example, that you described, and I think you're correct, that the one side is saying that the elites are oppressing us and Trump is going to set us free from it, and then you have another side that says that the elites are oppressing us and we need social democracy. And then there's other elements. There's some extreme elements in here too, like left and right. So anyway, I think that perhaps what I'm hearing or what I'm reading is that that race has something to do with the how the interpretations are coming about, even though they have the same, right? They see the same, they're getting the same picture of the big picture, but when they move to enact some kind of change, then it goes along race lines. Is this correct?
I mean, I would say that it's so much of it comes down to you see that there's a lot of inequality in around you, and you see that there's these elites that are getting richer and ruling everything, and everything is getting more expensive, and you see this reality happening around you, whoever you are in this society, if you're from the working class. And then you might draw very different conclusions about why all this is happening. And I think that's the main difference between the right and the left, actually, when it comes down to it in this country, regardless of the propaganda of both the right and left in terms of who the other is. I think that is really what it comes down to, is you have a different explanation and for who's oppressing you. And for the left, I mean, what we call the left today, I don't know exactly what their explanation is, and I'm not sure I'm a part of that left necessarily. But the class oriented left, of which I am a part, understands that those who are oppressing us are the ruling class, which is the extremely wealthy people who are basically conspiring to maintain their extreme wealth and maintain the extreme inequality. And they do this through corrupt mechanisms within the legal framework of our democratic system. And through other extra legal means of all kinds. But the right wing, when they look at that elite, they may or may not see, or they may see the same corporate, power and political influence. But behind it, rather than seeing plutocrats of all kinds, they see particular kinds of plutocrats, specifically Jewish plutocrats. And they see race is used as a tool to keep them oppressed in their view, and the people doing that oppressing in their view somehow or other are black and brown people. I don't know how they make all the mental gymnastics to come up with this kind of formula that their enemies are Jews and blacks. It's a very complex and bizarre, it's all really bizarre, but at least you can find a fair number of Jewish capitalists if you want to vilify Jews. How they can come up with that they're being oppressed by black people who are overwhelmingly obviously living in poverty in this society is hard to really get my head around, but this has been going on for a long time, the division of the races by the ruling class, and it's been very effective, divide and conquer. You have so many poor people from black and white backgrounds living in their own separate ghettos, and one neighborhood is a trailer park, and another it's crumbling apartment blocks, and they're all paying the same rent because their rent is determined by their fixed incomes on disability, and they all get the same fixed income, the poor. And that's what they pay in the place, in the trailer parks and the housing projects in Milwaukee, because that's what the landlords can get away with, mm-hmm. And it's been like that for a very long time.
This underlying theme of your writings then would be that let me try to put it this way, if that connection were to be made based on a human level, that people actually were, and a lot of U.S. history is this coming together of people that is U.S. history, and in fact the Constitution around the certain the best principles of the Constitution. Did create the United States with these particular, what I would say, good elements, right? And productive elements. I mean, building the country and so forth. And I do want to mention the Chinese, of course, that were brought in. But yeah, this is an interesting history. And if this could be bridged, then maybe there more progress could be done. I mean, is this something that you see? Is this?
Absolutely. And then even just mentioning the Constitution, it's so relevant to mention that the best part of the Constitution is the Bill of Rights. Most people would say, I would too. And the Bill of Rights got passed because of a rebellion. And, you know, after the American Revolution, there was the farmers of Western Massachusetts, the tenant farmers, because most farmers weren't at that time were not, you know, landowners. They were renting farmland from some rich English person or rich Dutch person, depending, or some other rich person. But they the tenant farmers of Western Massachusetts who had been off fighting and dying in the revolution during the time that they were away, the landlords wanted rent for the farms that they were not able to work on while they were off fighting in the Continental Army. And basically, to make a long story short, they rebelled and they took over the state for several years and went, or the western part of the state. And when the rebellion was put down, as it ultimately was, that's when the Bill of Rights came around as a direct reaction to Shay's rebellion, as a way of saying, okay, this we need to give these people something more than what they got, because they think they were fighting for freedom and democracy, and all we've given them is a new monarch.
This goes back to even to James Madison, who initially, of course, he wrote that if we distribute the land, or if we allow people to have the vote, if we have actual democracy, people are going to call for the distribution of the land, right? Shay's rebellion came later with the actual Bill of Rights. These were not easily, how should we say it, achieved.
And we never got any distribution of the land, really. I mean, we got the Homestead Act, which was a much better than the Bill of Rights in terms of any kind of distribution of land. Of course, the Bill of Rights was all about things unrelated to economics, basically, you know, speech and of course, the Constitution's kind of biggest failing is that it's not about property right, the rights to land and food and healthcare, any of that kind of stuff. It's the right to happiness is a hell of a lot more obscure than the right to property, which was originally going to be in the document, but that was omitted later and replaced with of course that's just in the preamble, right, which isn't legally binding anyway, but what is it, the right to life, liberty, and property was originally in the thing. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, might sound kind of like property, it's, you know, property, you know, for a lot of knee-jerk anarchists out there are thinking, oh, property is theft, you know. Well, you know, property, that's what we want. That's what we want is land. We want the land distributed, you know. It's theft when you steal it from everybody, but it's not theft when you distribute it properly, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly what Madison, anarchists should read Madison, right, to understand what's going on.
Sure.
This is an interesting history discussion, and I think that it could really be helpful for, you know, people listening in. When we hear about a genocidal kind of initial kind of infant empire, what Washington called the United States, we hear a lot about genocide. Of course, there was a war, and then the Constitutional Convention, and then later a civil war. This whole history. A lot of people that are in social justice, or they claim social justice or whatever, you know, they look at this history as if the United States is all genocide, all internal conflict, internal war. But that's not true, right? And this is what you are getting at with your piece.
Absolutely. It's too complicated to sum it up like it's all genocide. It's a ridiculous orientation. The United States is a settler colonial country. And it was set up on the basis of settler colonialism, and settler colonialism is a system that involves taking people who want to flee or leave their homelands for one reason or another, and making them settle another land, and displace people and exploit the land and exploit other people for the profit of the colonizing power. Which, you know, which was the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, and later, you know, the American independent sovereign state of the United States, you know, building its empire on its own, and with, you know, so, and who are the shock troops of settler colonialism? you know, they're what we call the, in the doctrine of subtle colonialism, they're the immigrants who are seeking a better life and wanting to be pioneers to forge Western civilization in the terra nullius of, you know, the West, you know. But of course, who they really are, in at least 90% of the cases, by my informal estimation, are refugees. And they were European refugees, because primarily because refugees weren't even allowed from most of the world, you know, with the exception of those who were, you know, under contract from China and Japan. And you know, there's a lot of other exceptions. But generally, if you wanted to immigrate, you know, the standard for being able to immigrate was to be European. And because we had the whites-only immigration policy in this country, which Australia, New Zealand, and other settler colonial countries, Canada also had, and that only changed, you know, in the 20th century. And there were all sorts of laws in the immigration policy that were specifically targeting Southern Europeans and Eastern Europeans. So it wasn't even just a whites-only immigration policy. It was very much a Western European immigration policy, a very favored Western European immigration. But even among those Western European immigrants, you know, or the Central or Eastern immigrants from Europe who largely populated, who made up the settler population of this settler colonial country, even among them, they were mostly refugees. And if you trace your own family history, generally mm-hmm. most people will find that you're descended from refugees. And there's a lot of reasons why we changed that narrative, a lot of different, you know, officially and unofficially, in all kinds of different ways. So of course that refugee narrative has been changed, and now we're all immigrants who came seeking a better life, and we didn't leave because we were fleeing war and pogroms and famine and monarchy and torture. But that's what we were doing, we refugees, we people descended from European refugees. And so then we are told that, you know, all this is that all the inequality in this society is basically, you know, rooted in this formula of white privilege relative to the oppression of the rest of the population. And that's ridiculous, because I mean, this is a population that's been divided and conquered, and some people are privileged relative to others in that process of dividing and conquering, and that's classic colonial practice. And people have to understand basic classic colonial practice. If you're going to say that you know, because of it's the settler colonial system, white people are somehow all the enemy, not to you know, that would be way oversimplifying to say that anybody is proposing that, but just to oversimplify, I mean, it's like the Sunni people in Iraq are not the enemy either, you know. The Tutsi people in Rwanda are not the enemy, you know. I mean, it's these were divisions. You know, the Protestants in Ireland are not the enemy. These were divisions that were created, and then, you know, and then if you're going to just perpetuate these divisions by embracing the very ideas that the colonial powers put out there of the superiority of these minorities that the colonial powers, or majorities in the case of white people in the United States, that the colonial powers used to keep everybody else down, you know, everybody has to understand that dynamic. And mm-hmm. and if you just embrace the very misunderstanding of reality that the colonial powers are handing us about the superiority of one group over another, and in some way or another, you don't embrace the idea that this group is superior, but you embrace the idea that the problems in society are all about these divisions that have been created for us,
right?
Well, that's just really defeatist, and also inaccurate.
In your work as a musician, let me ask you some more personal experience. you're writing about this solidarity that you speak of, indigenous women's leaders at the Cream Corn Rebellion, the black soldiers, and the, what was it, 2,000 black soldiers, along with 13,000 white soldiers, in the most important uprising 100 years ago. And also that was organized by a union, working class union, right?
Well, the Green Corn Uprising in Oklahoma, the Working Class Union was the secret organization, okay, that had been engaged actually in a campaign of sabotage for years prior to, mm-hmm, this abortive attempted march on Washington. But in 1921, the Battle of Blair Mountain, it was a massive event, but it was not organized by the union. It was organized by union workers, and actually the union itself, the union leadership, was beseeching the workers to abandon their march because they were afraid they'd be slaughtered. But people were just so outraged by the slaughter of women and children, by firing into the tent camps of striking miners, by the gun thugs employed by the companies, and Mother Jones and other UMWA United Mine Workers organizers had been successfully getting the marchers to turn around and go home. And then there was a massacre of women and children in the town of Sharples, West Virginia, by the Pinkerton gun thugs. And the marchers heard about that, and they just turned back around and continued on towards Mingo.
If you're writing about this kind of history, and yet you go to, you're supposed to give a talk or play a gig, and then all of a sudden you find out that you've been deplatformed. Of course, this certainly feels, it's a difficult thing individually, but also socially, this is creating a kind of, totalitarian stream going on. And a lot of this is coming from people who are espousing the very things that you're talking about, or they say they espouse it. What is this kind of schizophrenic kind of, I'll let you handle it there. What do you think?
I mean, one thing I think that has to be understood about the whole deplatforming idea is that this is not new. And this did not just start with the sort of more fanatical elements of the movement that has been going on for the past couple of years. It also did not start with the battles in the streets of Portland and cities around North America, Europe, and elsewhere during the 80s around the whole sort of Nazi skinhead and opposition, mm-hmm, to the Nazi skinhead movement. I mean, this goes way, way back. Certainly in the 1930s, it was a big thing, sort of platforming and the idea of fascists not having a platform to organize anywhere. And, I don't want to try to summarize a complex history and say one thing was right or wrong. It's complex and it varies from place to place. But overall, generally, I'd say that the deplatforming idea has been more of a problem, has been more of a totalitarian tendency that is very problematic rather than anything positive. Basically it's been bad, and it has been bad for a very long time. It was a bad idea in the 1930s generally too. I don't think that you're gonna, I think that you only give people more power when you try to ban them and when you block them. And that's not just true for the state censoring people, which I think the state generally is very careful about not needing to censor people, because you don't get to get on the radio or TV unless you're already, being promoted by a massive corporation in the first place, mm-hmm, most of the time. So that effectively censors most people, without needing to actually censor people, because censorship doesn't work. Censorship just makes people famous. you know, unless you can do it really, really well, like, you know, just make people disappear into the bowels of your prison and system and they're never heard from again.
It's interesting what you're talking about here, because Noam Chomsky was doing an interview with the BBC, and the young man said to Noam, he said, "Well, I say what I want, and I'm a journalist." And Noam said, "You wouldn't be sitting there if you didn't already think that." Can you just make a just quick comment on this particular exchange?
Yeah, absolutely, right? I mean, the idea that a BBC journalist says what they want, I mean, yeah, what they wouldn't be working there if they didn't already see the BBC as some kind of a objective journalistic entity that they want to help improve by working for them, or at least they wouldn't put forth a different opinion than that. Otherwise, they wouldn't be working for the BBC very long. I mean, so the position is ridiculous. I mean, if you had the opinion of the BBC that a lot of people have who work for, I don't know, press TV in Iran, you know, they wouldn't be employing you at the BBC for very long, I'm pretty sure. You'd end up washing the toilets pretty quick, you know, rather than doing anything with a microphone.
So this process of censorship you're talking about is a selection process. They're already selecting people that already have a particular ideology. But when the young person gets there, they think, oh, I have a great job. I get to say what I want.
Yeah. And that is it's very interesting, the whole selection process that like that, how that happens, because it is, you know, it's not like so simple, like, you know, you have to think this way and then we'll give you a job,
right.
You know, it's more complex, but right. You know, it's a selection process that starts at birth and it continues on to private schools, or what in England they call public schools. But, you know, you go to a private academies, you know, with the cream of the crop, the top 10% of the society. And then you go to an Ivy League college after that. And then, you know, then, you know, you apply for your job at BBC. You know, you don't do it otherwise. You don't go to a community college and then apply for a job at BBC. You're not going to get that job. And you know, so you don't even try. And if you do, you don't get hired. You know, so it's the Ivy League graduates who went to the private schools, which is why they got into the Ivy League in the first place. So in order to go to all those schools in the first place, they already had to have grown up in one of the richest parts of the country, you know, like they already grew up in a county like the one I grew up in Fairfield County, Connecticut, or Westchester County, New York. They already have a totally skewed perspective on reality based on privilege and growing up with privilege and then living a relatively privileged life up until the time they get their job at BBC. And that might be the first time they have to deal with I don't know. I mean, depending on the person, I mean, that might be the least privileged situation they get into by the time they get the job at BBC and realize it doesn't pay all that well compared to how expensive it is to live in London, you know?
Right, but, these days.
Yeah.
The society that you would like to see, you wrote a song about this. I call it a Star Trek society, or, you know, some kind of advanced technical echo society. What would you like to see?
I mean, I'm really flexible, ecumenical, open about, you know, that I'd just like to see a society where the air continues to be breathable, and, you know, where the, you know, the food grows and the water can be drunk. And, you know, I mean, we're at such a crossroads here with existential crossroads that I'd be just happy with. If the solution is going to be high tech or primitivist or anywhere in between, I'm up for it, you know, as long as we can survive. And you know, I would love to see a future where you don't have, you know, half the human race, you know, suffering with war and poverty and disease. And, you know, I mean, it'd be, what is it, 40% of people in this country don't know what they would, you know, basically an emergency involving more than a few $100 is something they are not in any position to deal with, you know.
Yes.
One in four children goes to bed hungry in this country. I'd like to see a society where those things are not the norm. But how that happens, I mean, it could go, it could be achieved in lots of different ways. And I'm not a ideologue, and I don't think that there's only one way forward in terms of achieving some kind of egalitarian society. And actually, you know, I get in a lot of arguments or discussions with a lot of people about this, because I think partly it's really helpful to travel, and a lot of people don't travel because they can't afford to or whatever, but it's really helpful to travel. And if you have, at least for me, I would say if you've spent a lot of time in Scandinavia and you've spent a lot of time in the US, you know, and I've spent a lot of time in a lot of other countries, but just contrasting those places with each other, you know, you don't need to, you can see easily in places like Denmark or even, you know, in lots of other countries in Europe that aren't as well run as Denmark, that you don't need to have, you know, like some kind of radical socialist solution or anarchist, or, I mean, you can just, there, it would be such a massive improvement on things as they are here if we could just have really basic European standards of governance. Like if we had, you know, any kind of like democratic system where there were really actually more than two parties, you know, that didn't both think we should spend half of our taxes on the military. You know, we don't really have a democracy here. It's our main problem. And if we could have some kind of a democracy, like by, you know, like they have in Europe, then things would have naturally improved dramatically, because you can only have such a dysfunctional society without democracy. I mean, the level of dysfunctionality here is only possible without democracy. I mean, because there is no democracy in the world anywhere where you would find a population interested in voting for a party that wants to spend half of your taxes on the military. There's none anywhere. The only time that you can have a democracy where anyone will vote for a party that wants to spend half of your taxes on the military is when both major parties want to spend half your taxes on the military. That's the only time that it happens anywhere. There's no examples anywhere in the world, now or historically, of a majority of a population voting for a party that wants to spend half your money on the military when there is a viable alternative in a multi-party system. It's never happened. It only happens here.
Yeah, and you're working on this current housing crisis, which could use some money, right, from the $3.5 trillion that's coming about. Let me ask you, of course, at Blair Mountain, they didn't have open source and apps and phones. They basically were forced into a situation where all they had was guns, right, the only kind of technology. But in the case of what you're doing and what you see people doing in the United States all over, because you're traveling and talking with folks and singing and sharing, what do you think is possible? What's going on and so forth?
I mean, it seems to me that the situation with technology is so dismal. I mean, because as it seemed so hopeful in the 90s
the cypherpunks and so forth.
Yeah, and just the freedom of the internet and this, the fact that it was this open source free, you know, and it is, but you know, it's been so much successfully taken over by certain big tech corporations through means now familiar to most people. But the internet isn't the internet anymore, right? It's largely, for most people, it's a collection of massive corporations that are sucking up all your data and using them to dominate the world. And, you know, so what I see in terms of anti-social media, which is where most people spend most of their time online, it seems, if they're not like buying stuff on Amazon or viewing porn, you know, it's just causing the further dissolution of society. I think it's one of the main causes of it, really. And all people seem to do on those platforms is argue with each other, and that's built into the whole algorithms of the platforms and how they work. It's just Facebook makes it really impossible to do any effective organizing on their platform. I mean, Facebook is really just good for you know, sensational news consumption and arguing, and it'll make sure to promote posts that will promote arguments, and it won't, and nobody's going to see the link to your essay, you know, that, that really explains your points. And if they do see it, they're not going to click on it. But they're probably not going to see it in the first place, because, you know, it's a link, you know, takes you off of the platform. And, you know, it's just such a mess. So, I mean, I think there's reason to be optimistic about technology, potentially, some technologies, but the dominant technology of social media that is, you know, taking up so much of our time and energy, it's overwhelmingly negative impact, I'd say.
In the case of the, I agree, for Facebook, for well, TikTok and so forth, for the activists, are they writing their own apps, or what are they using? I mean, what kinds of technology are they using? Maybe Zoom for organizing, or maybe writing some apps, or?
I mean, I think there's, there, when we come into this whole, I mean, I think certainly in among, you know, technologically savvy activist types, there's all kinds of, you know, app creation and programming of all kinds going on, and creating all kinds of different alternative platforms. And certainly within the music world, there's lots of organizing around trying to create alternatives to the sort of vulture capitalist model of Spotify. And,
you know, oh, yeah, that's right. But there's some new ones I see coming about, right, that artists are using.
There are, but the problem is there with any of these alternatives in whatever forum, whether it's music or organizing or any number of communication, social media is a great example. You know, it only becomes useful if a lot of other people are doing it. And so, you know, if everybody's still on Spotify or everyone's still on Facebook, then your alternative platforms aren't going to really do much. And, you know, you can't organize if nobody's on the platform to organize, and you're not going to make money streaming music to people that aren't there to listen to it. So, you know, the once you've got an infrastructure where the superhighway is called Facebook and Spotify, you know, then you need to use the infrastructure, and you need to fight to control it, because it's not going to go away, and you're not going to convince everybody to get their flashlights out and take the cow path instead of the highway, you know, when they already got their cars and they're all ready, you know, to drive and go fast. And, you know, it's just the way it is. They got the, you know, they got the means, and we need to take them on, I think, somehow. But it's, I don't think, I mean, and creating alternative models is a good thing, but and a necessary thing. But it's the same as organizing in the physical world. I mean, you know, we can, it's important to have all organic farms that show everybody that you don't need pesticides, but that's not going to make all the pesticide farmers convert to organic farming. You need a much bigger effort than that. That needs to be systemic, not just, you know, somebody, you know, designing an app or starting up a farm.
Mm-hmm. There are more, technology is not going to solve it, but it can be an accessory to help.
Oh yeah, big time.
In closing, for your efforts there, in the communities around you in Oregon, in Portland, you said in a previous conversation that it's dire situation. People are going to lose their homes. Can you talk a little bit about that before we close here?
Yeah, I mean, Portland is very contradictory, but Portland is, as a city, the most rent burdened city in the United States in terms of the income, average income relative to average cost of monthly rent or mortgage. So, but it's also within the state of Oregon, which is these days one of the more progressive states when it comes to policies related to, you know, most everything. So even though it's a very expensive place to live, and increasingly expensive, and the government intentionally takes very little, you know, are you still there?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. You just disappeared from my screen for a moment, but now you're back. And the government here takes very little, you know, it really takes a hands-off policy to a housing market, which basically means it's, you know, it's up to the capitalists to do what they want. but because there's a relatively progressive state government, that we have the moratorium that extends to the end of the year, so it's not going to become a crisis. They're kicking the can down the road here, better than they are in most parts of the country. But that's all they're doing is kicking the can down the road, and eventually there's going to be a major crisis. But possibly, in at least this state anyway, they may avert the crisis until the aid money that's out there actually gets dispersed, which would make sense. That would be like a sort of functional thing for a government to do, right? But in other states, they have there is no more moratorium. The aid money is not reaching the renters, and the eviction waves of eviction have begun, and they are very much happening in process right now, in progress right now, in a lot of places, like in Georgia, Alabama, and Texas, in a lot of places.
Okay, I'll add links to your articles and to this effort that you have for the evictions and so forth down below. David Rovix, thank you very much for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Lane. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.